Welcome back to the Ramble Room. I'm Ken, and I am not flying solo, but Diane and Sarah and Joe are taking the night off, a well-deserved night off. With me this evening, though, are some people that you may well be familiar with. Todd Windsor is with us. He's been on the show before.
Hi. So,
David Iverson is here.
Hey, Ken.
You've been here before?
No, you've never seen me here before. Dave's not here, man.
Anytime you can make it, I'm delighted to have you. And Joey Correnti is here. He's been on the show, but this is the first time you've actually been here in person, so delighted to see you face-to-face again.
Yeah, it's good to be in studio, and I was surprised to see how easy it was coming up to Sheridan that you can drive I-25 and I-90 without going into oncoming traffic fairly easily.
It can be done.
Well, we did get to go through that
soon-to-be
renamed interchange, Joey.
Yes.
It's a lot different at 2:30 in the morning, Joey.
I wouldn't know. I work for the people, so normally I'm asleep at 2:30 in the morning.
Okay, this is going to take a while. That's why they call it the Ramble Room. Today we wanted to talk about every 10 years there is a census, and as a result of that census, it is laid upon each state legislature the responsibility for redistricting to make sure that everything is fair and even and done appropriately. And we're just going to discuss some ideas about that. I'm going to let Joey kick us off. This is something, tell the folks what it is you're doing in your committee and what responsibility you have, and contrast that, if you would, with the responsibility of the legislature.
Could you give him a bigger list, Ken?
I could.
Yeah, recite the Gettysburg Address, from memory at the beginning.
This means the rest of us won't have to talk.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, lucky you guys.
He got the coolest voice.
Well, I am I'm a co-chair of the Wyoming Republican Party Redistricting Committee. I'm co-chairs with the former Representative Scott Klim. And what we're tasked with is really taking the concept and the process of redistricting as a legislative action and looking at what is the party's intent and expectation of how that legislative action works, and what does the Constitution say we have to do, what do federal laws say we have to do, and how can we make sure that we're adhering or having the legislature adhere to what we support, which is the Constitution of the state of Wyoming. We do have a platform plank, I believe it's the 12th plank of the Wyoming Republican platform, that says the Constitution cannot be changed through judicial activism or judicial review. And the situation we're in Wyoming is we have a constitutional Article 3, Section 3 provision that says redistricting shall be done along county lines. And that's been deemed unconstitutional by a court decision in 1991 based on the 14th Amendment, the principle of one person, one vote. The problem is that was 30 years ago. And it has never triggered the legislative action of actually producing an amendment to the Constitution to embrace that judicial relief. So for the last three redistricting cycles, the legislature has been running around with a hall pass from a judge and has never put the question to the people, will you ratify this court decision? So that's the first thing we asked for, was if you're going to continue to do it this way, at least have the Constitution legally amended through a ratification vote of the people, and say that this is the way we do it, and have it in our governing document. I've yet to get a response. I've testified to the committee twice specifically on that, and I don't know that there was audible laughter, but I could tell they were ready to say, yeah. I think the only response I've gotten was after a meeting, I talked to one of the committee members, and they said, oh yeah, you want us to write a resolution to amend the Constitution so we can ignore the Supreme Court. I said, no, I'm asking the opposite.
Let's follow the Constitution, yeah. Why don't we?
How often are you going to get a representative of a major political party to come and talk to a legislative committee and say, here's how you steal my argument from me. I can't complain if you fix the Constitution that you're ignoring. And so that's really the big ask. As far as the process, we expect that the legislature will look at and maintain county lines as much as possible, knowing that they can just say, forget you guys, and we have judicial relief. But we really want to hold them accountable to making every effort and let them know that our expectation really doesn't result in redistricting being done constitutionally, because you're obviously not going to do it. But we do have an election in 2022.
Yeah.
And those who decide to just say, you know what, forget the party, forget the people, forget the Constitution, I think we'll have a legitimate argument. Wyoming redistricting is fairly cut and dry, because we do not have to worry about redistricting our U.S. House districts. We have one. It will be quite some time before we have any more than, you know, one House representative. And we have the same two senators that every other state has, so there is no district there. So it really comes down to, how are you districting your legislative districts, and what's happened so far? And I'm fairly comfortable with it. It's not a 100% win for following the Constitution, but it is a good start. The state has been tentatively broken into 10 regions, and I don't have the list in front of me, but Laramie County is its own region. I believe Albany County is its own region. Natrona is its own region. And then there is a conglomeration of other counties making up their own regions.
The objective being trying to make every district approximately the same number of persons.
The same number of persons that equal the what we call the Goldilocks zone for a Senate district, because you can always nest two House districts inside of a Senate district.
Right.
And the proposal with the 10 districts right now tentatively does not cross county lines of those, sorry, districts, regions. So, for example, I live in Carbon County, and right now they propose that Carbon and Sweetwater County be its own region. And the intent is for the legislature to not push anything crossing outside of Carbon or Sweetwater. So everything that will be districted legislatively will be within those two counties. Now, we're at the point where that's done at the committee level, and they have to get feedback from the local level. So all across the state in these 10 regions, you are having legislators, county clerks, county commissioners, the public coming together for meetings. And those meetings is where those individuals will say, hey, like Albany County is going to be its own region. How do we want to do this? Do we need to give some population over to Carbon County, which we already have? And I think this is going to reverse that, actually. We're going to be giving Rock River back to Albany County. On the other side, the legislature, at least the committee, needs to know. Down in Uinta County, where they have Uinta, Lincoln, and Sublette in a region, Uinta County on the east side is probably going to need some population from rural Sweetwater County. But that's really between those two counties to discuss. So I'm kind of pleased that it's gotten to the point where we have a broad strokes plan, which is about 50% of the way to what the Republican Party was asking for. And the rest of the decisions, even if it crosses county lines, are really going to be made by the people. So this is going to be a pure, yes, your legislators are going to be there, your county clerks are going to be there, but the victory is going to go to the people that show up to these local meetings and say, no, we don't want to share the corner of the county. Or, yes, absolutely, they're rural, this side of the county's rural. Let's make it work. And it's going to be up to the people who get involved.
A lot of times people that live on one of these arbitrary borders find that they identify much more closely with people on the other side of the line than they might do by the arbitrary line. David, you've got something there.
That was kind of the part that really impressed me at the Corporations Committee hearing, is trying to keep like communities together. So, for example, Johnson County has got this weird little finger that runs up the edge, and it includes Leiter, Claremont, and Arvada. Well, all of those three smaller communities associate more with Johnson County and Buffalo than they do Sheridan County. So it makes sense to keep those in the same district. And I kind of liked the idea of keeping, like, whatever community exists together in its own district, even though it might make for some weird sort of lines.
How does that affect the job of county clerks? That seems to me a problem.
It is, and that's where my big fight is going to come, with either amend the Constitution, and as we start going through, you know, clerks aren't clerks forever, and this only happens once every 10 years. So as we start bringing on new clerks, some clerks retire, making this really the standard, because it's now the Constitution, not a fight we have every 10 years that could go either way. But every time you cross what you called an imaginary line, which I call a constitutionally recognized boundary.
I said arbitrary.
Arbitrary. It does create another split on a ballot for a clerk to deal with. I would prefer that we did county lines. It would be cleaner across the board. It would be easier on the clerks. But right now, and it's being challenged in court, not in Wyoming, but the 14th Amendment ruling on this one person, one vote, counties are not sovereign entities, which I agree, they're not sovereign entities, but it really needs to be. I mean, those lines are there for a reason. And to say one person, one vote exists, and you can cross bounty, you have to cross county lines because of it, and then at the same time saying, you know, the Niobrara County Commissioners are allowed to have three, and the Laramie County Commissioners are allowed to have five, I don't see the balance in representation there. If we were doing this one person, one vote, proper representation thing as a real principle across the board, you'd have 247 commissioners in Laramie County, and we just don't do it that way. So it is an extra set of work on the clerk every time you create a new split, specifically in a primary, because for every primary ballot that is created, which means each precinct and every split for every division, which school boards create another split, different tax districts, different water districts, and then you're creating another split on top of that. Now take all that, whatever that number is, you know, yo, we only have 15 precincts, but I'm guaranteeing you those 15 precincts, you have 36 different ballots at least. And then multiply it by three because you have two separate parties that have to vote each of those. And you're looking at a horrific number of ballots that all have to be accurate and all have to be produced in a certain time frame. And that's only in the years when there's two major parties. In 2016, the Constitution and Libertarian Party both achieved temporarily major political party status.
Maybe you ought to define what that is, Joey.
Which means that the clerks had to print four primary ballots and a nonpartisan ballot for the primary election. Major and minor political parties are basically defined as any political party whose candidate for U.S. House of Representatives or governor, or I don't know the whole list of offices, garnered 10% plus one in the last general election. So if you're between 2% and 10%, you're what's called a minor party. If your candidate gets more than 10%, you're considered a major party. And if you're less than 2%, you're a provisional party. You're not even really a party. But the problem with that I have is that there's even a distinction. We're supposed to be the equality state, yet we have special rules for the two major parties, which are, I think there's 20 plus provisions, and each provision has 15 or 16 different sub-provisions. So you're looking at over 100 rules for major parties and only 7 for the minor parties. And then, so they get what I would consider extra freedom to operate independently as a private corporation, as all parties are. But conversely, the minor parties are told, no, you're not allowed to participate in primary elections, and we're going to spend taxpayer dollars to do the balloting and elections for these two special big parties over here. It's just, it's ridiculous.
We've talked about trying to get rid of that.
It's on the list.
Yes, we need to do that. I want to take us back because I don't want to get so far in the weeds that everybody just clicks off and goes off there. A lot of people sleep with a teddy bear, or so I've heard.
Well, I sleep with the Constitution.
That's exactly where I was leading it to. And one of the things that Joey said in his opening remarks is laying out what constitutionally is required. You've got it there. Would you be willing to share with us what is constitutionally required? Take us back to the basics.
Sure. It's pretty dry reading, but here we go. Each county shall constitute... Oh, well, this is Article 3, Section 3 of the Wyoming Constitution. It says, each county shall constitute a senatorial and representative district. The Senate and the House of Representatives shall be composed of members elected by the legal voters of the counties, respectively, every 2 years. They shall be apportioned among the said counties as nearly as may be according to the number of their inhabitants. Each county shall have at least one senator and one representative. That's the interesting part, each county. Mm-hmm. But at no time shall the number of members of the House of Representatives be less than twice, nor greater than three times the number of members of the Senate. The Senate and the House of Representatives first elected in pursuance of this Constitution shall consist of 16 and 33 members, respectively. So if you do the math, we don't need nearly as many representatives as we have.
But all those committees, everybody's overburdened if we don't have enough to share all the committee work.
Oh, poor them. They're so burdened.
It also gives the lobbyists enough people to have lunch with.
You know, I never thought of that. Maybe I'm chasing the wrong career here.
And honestly, if we took a look at the committees that the state have established to legislate and regulate the institutions of state government and actually compared them through a public review to what's legitimate, we could get rid of half of the committees.
I don't understand why
we shouldn't be doing half this stuff as a government.
Yeah, I don't understand why committees have names, because the speaker and the other leadership sit up there, and we've talked about this too. They sit up there and they decide not what committee would be appropriate to discuss this legislation, but what group of people can we give this to that will get our desired response from.
Right. Well, you end up with dumb stuff like Medicaid expansion going to the revenue committee.
Yes.
Committees are like dog treats. You know, if you do a good job, you get a treat and you get a committee. If you do a really good job, you could be in charge of the committee.
One of the questions I got asked during the last campaign was, what committee would you like to serve on? And it really took me back, because
you should have said committee of the whole.
Because I know that it doesn't matter. In fact, if I voiced an opinion about where I'd like to be, I can guarantee the leadership wouldn't give that to me. But in thinking about what, and Joey, you alluded to this, and you're dead right, I don't know what percentage of the stuff that the state government is involved with that there is no constitutional reason for them to be involved with. But if we just cut back the state government to what it was constitutionally required to do, we'd probably get by with 3 or 4 committees at most.
Yeah, and we'd just have excess money.
Oh, there's no such thing.
We could start that now by merging appropriations and revenue as a single committee.
Exactly. They should be the same committee.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about a ridiculous example, like the TRW committee. They just voted to move a bill to give $3 million to Hollywood. First of all, I don't think that Hollywood needs any money. Second, I don't think they need any of our money. And third, I don't think that we should be spending taxpayer dollars giving subsidies to like major corporations that really don't care about the state of Wyoming.
More picking winners and losers, trying to buy favor.
Right. I'll agree with everything you said except for one thing.
I knew there was one thing.
I know it's easier to say this because everybody else understands it, but my mom would just have my hide if I didn't correct you and say, it's not actually Hollywood, it's Burbank that's getting all the money.
Burbank, California. That's true. That's where all the headquarters are.
You know, everyone says, oh, well, the capital is in Cheyenne. Yeah, but the work gets done everywhere else. It's the same thing. You know?
All right.
Everybody knows Cheyenne. But,
so again,
by the way, it's the temporary capital of Wyoming is in Cheyenne.
Yeah. Again, if you're sitting there with your eyes kind of glazing over at some of this stuff a little bit in the weeds, the purpose is to try to make it fair. We've got to have a certain number of senators, a certain number of representatives for the state, and we want to have some sort of a relatively fair way of choosing them, so that each representative represents about the same amount of people.
Well, I think the other purpose is to avoid gerrymandering, too.
Oh.
I mean, I don't think we have that big of a problem with it in Wyoming, but, I mean, certainly the potential is there.
So gerrymandering. If you picture in your mind's eye a fried egg, and in the center of the egg is the yolk, and that's the city, and the white of the egg is the rural areas around there, and we all know that for whatever reasons, there are probably several, left-leaning people tend to congregate in cities, and right-leaning people tend to gravitate toward rural areas. It's just a rule of thumb. So if you're going to take this area, let's just say you have this fried egg that you're going to divide into districts, two different philosophies as I see it. One is you go ahead and you take some districts and concentrate them in the yolk, and you say, now we're going to have some left-leaning legislators. And we're going to take the white, similar districts, and we're going to separate that up. Now you're going to have some right-leaning ones. So now you've got some of those. On the other hand, you might say, let's take that egg and slice it like you would a pizza. So you got all these little pizza slices. So you got some of the inner city, and you got some of the rural areas. What you effectively do in that case, in my opinion, at least as far as I've thought it through, is you end up only being able to elect moderates. On the other hand, you might actually get some real representation by clumping, and we mentioned this earlier, by clumping like-minded peoples and things together so they can actually have a representative. All that to say, what?
Gerrymandering.
Well, it's not so much, you use the example of a pizza, but problem with that example is that if you put a city in the middle of your egg yolk,
yeah,
and you slice it like a pizza, there's a good chance that even though the fringes are a bigger area, that the dense population in the middle still outnumbers,
yes,
the fringes.
Yes.
And that's how you get the moderates, or you still have even the you know, more left-leaning people who dominate that little tiny point of the pizza wedge in the middle that outnumber everybody else, yeah. And then you don't get so
if we do that and we tend to get more left-leaning or more moderate candidates than we might be able to do otherwise, and we end up in an election like we're going to have here shortly for U.S. House, and you've got a dozen people running, or however many we end up with.
47.
Yeah. And we end up reflecting back to the last gubernatorial race where Governor Gordon gets in with, what, 30% maybe? How do we fix that? How do we come up with different ways of being able to say, if you're going to be put on a general ballot, you have to have made, let's just say, 51% of the vote?
Well, that's a whole other discussion. That's called a runoff election.
It is.
Yes.
Well, or
part of it, yeah.
Or are there other methods that have been suggested? Would you guys care to pick some of those, support some, pick others apart?
I don't know that we really need to necessarily, because in the forefront, what happened last week at the Corporations Committee meeting was there were three options presented. One was an open, what we call jungle primary. Yep. One was a ranked choice voting system, and one was runoffs. And the only one that survived to be killed another day was was runoffs. So even...
Thank you, Chippy.
Even with the constituency of that committee... The other two ideas I don't even think really need to be discussed. If your listeners want to call me and talk about them, I can point them. You can learn about them. But we would really need to talk about runoffs, because that's what we're looking at being possible, but not for this next election.
We do. Just understand that part of the Ramble Room's persona is that we have a lot of people that are very new to politics, don't understand even the rudiments of it. And so we try not to just assume somebody's going to understand something. We want to be able to lay that information out there. Well, so if you're talking about these first two examples that did not make it, let's just kind of plainly state what the problem is.
Let's just start with the runoff election. Yeah. The concept behind the runoff election is, say you have 47 people running for Congress in this next election, and the top vote getter gets 18% of the vote. And that person would go with 18% support, would go to the general election. And if they're a Republican in Wyoming, they're almost guaranteed of getting elected, yep, because the state is 70% Republican.
Which is why we have so many moderates where we're at.
Exactly. So,
what
so
you call them moderates, Ken.
No. So the whole concept upon a runoff election is you take the two top vote getters, you know, the one with 18%, the one with 17.5%, and you put them in a race against each other, and that way at least whoever gets 51% of the vote or over 50% of the vote then goes to the general. The big problem with a runoff election is timing, because right now we have our primaries in August and the general's in November, and there's not enough time in between. I mean, there probably is, but there's not enough time for most people in between to campaign for a runoff, to run an election, and then campaign for the general against the other parties. So the whole problem that has to be overcome with the runoff election is timing. Move the primary election cycle up earlier, and then to allow time for a runoff election. Now, if you, in the primary, if you don't have anybody who got less than 50% of the vote, you don't have the runoff election. But you know, as we've seen in the last governor's race, the senatorial race, and we'll see that in this upcoming congressional race, it's going to be the cast of thousands running, and whoever wins will have significantly less than 50% of the vote. And do you really want, you know, 30% of the population picking your next person that you may or may not agree with? So, but that seems to be the most workable of all of them. The ranked choice was one of the other ones. Yeah. And you talk about a can of worms. You know, people already have very little faith in the election process, especially after this last presidential election. Ranked choice, and Joey mentioned all the ballots required. Mm-hmm. So ranked choice requires the voter to put down in order preference their candidates. So I like this guy the best, and this would be my second choice, and this would be my third choice, and this would be my fourth choice, up to potentially five choices, or if there's 47 people on the ballot, 47 choices. Mm-hmm. And then the Secretary of State has to write some sort of algorithm that goes in and matches up everybody's, who got the most top choices, who got this, and then pair them up and start kicking people out based on not being top choices. And eventually they, you know, they put in this big machine and they turn the crank and out pops the person who got the most top choices. Well, it's not necessarily everybody's number one choice. It could be your number two choice because it had the most, everybody voted for one person as number two, and the number one, because some people liked that person or hated, they were divisive. Some people really liked them, some people really hated them, and they don't even pop out. And I mean, it's talk about trying to educate the voter, which this has been done in several states. And I mean, there's Maine or somebody had like a 19 or 20 page instruction manual on how to vote. I mean, for Pete's sake, you know, all of our lives we have been voting for, I choose this one over this one. This is my choice. That's the way we're programmed. Mm-hmm. And now all of a sudden we got to do a ranked choice. You know, I spent a lifetime in marketing, and I can tell you from market research studies, those ones where you have to like rank your choices or your preferences, you know, if you don't have to use those, you don't use them because people don't understand them and they're really hard to calculate. So
how many shades of gray are we dealing with?
Exactly. So it's a, you know, that one's got serious issues. And then the other one, the jungle primary, the open primary.
Yes.
Oh my God. That one is, that gets rid of, it takes the primary away from the party and makes it just a primary election. And, you know, everybody who, you know, especially if you don't want to declare a political party and you want to vote and you think everybody, you should judge the candidate on their merits. Everybody who has those arguments loves that open primary because that pits everybody together. Well, you know, they don't have to declare a party. They can be on there and not declare a party. And so you have to know that, for instance, if Joey runs, that Joey may or may not share your mindset and your principles.
It would require a tremendous amount of diligence on the part of the average voter.
Exactly.
Which we already know isn't going to happen.
And, you know, the average voter kind of goes on Monday, oh, crap, tomorrow's election day. I need to vote. Who should I vote for? You know, and they start calling their friends, or they start thinking back to who they remember getting the most shiny, what I call shiny stuff, mailings, yeah. And they've heard ads, yeah, from and stuff. And I've heard their ads. I should vote for them. They don't do any research, and I apologize if I offended anyone for that, but the average voter really doesn't research anybody. And so, you know, right now the best thing we have is our party primaries, where you know that the Republican Party or the Democrat Party viewpoint and platform most align with your personal viewpoint and platform, and so you tend to vote for those candidates. Now, out of the ones running on those in those parties, you should do at least a little research to see which one of those you like the best, or most closely represents what you think. So we're already doing that to some degree, but we're doing within the confines of the party. And to make the open primary even worse, they got rid of, right now, what's in the primary is the precinct committee people elections. And
by far were, the most important.
Which are by far, yes. I mean, that's where the grassroots of politics start. And, you know, if you've never run for a precinct committee person office, and you have any thought or any complaints about how politics are being done, you should run for precinct committee person. They are, it's free to register. You're within your precinct, which you probably know a lot of the people around you. And oftentimes, those precinct races are, they're uncontested, or there's nobody that even files for them. So, which means the party has to go and track down people who might be interested, or if your name is written in by your person you hate next door, and they put your name on there because they want you to be a precinct person, you know, you get a call. It's like, hey, your name's been written in, and would you like to be a precinct person? So
you say this from personal experience, it sounds like.
How do you think I got to be a precinct person? So it takes that away from the party primary, and it basically gets rid of the whole party primary concept, which is the foundation of elections.
Okay.
And since I'm on a roll...
You keep going, then.
Party primaries run by the government...
That's exactly where I was. That's exactly where I was going to go.
Did not exist till about 1900 or 1910. And they were, before that time, the party got together and... in a caucus or a convention or whatever meeting, a smoky beer-filled hall or beer-filled smoky hall, whatever it is. And, you know, they picked who their candidates were going to be for everything, and then they put them on a slate for the general election. What happened with the progressive movement of the early 20th century is that they decided that they needed to break the power of the Tammany Hall and all these other good old boy little networks. And so they decided to start having public primary elections. And it really kind of didn't come into play till around 1912. So it's really a modern concept. And, you know, and if you talk to a party purist, they would like to get rid of the public primary election.
Well, here's a reason for that. You call me a purist or not. You talked about having a runoff election, and the two objections you hear is time and money.
Right. Mm-hmm.
We don't have the time. Well, a private party can set up their own election on their own time scale. It doesn't matter. And money, we've already talked about how here's the state giving preference to two major primaries, mm-hmm. two major parties, and giving them help and paying for their elections. Let's just take the state out of that. Let's have these parties set up independently. Here's what we're going to have, and you've got to have somebody to put on this ballot by this date.
Well, if I could jump in here, the main objection to a runoff election, like you said, is time and money. But the real reason why it's opposed is it would eliminate the very problem that we have in Wyoming, which is very liberal people running on the Republican ticket, because the only way that they can get elected is if they put an R beside their name.
Well,
if
which you, stands for red coat, or I get confused sometimes.
Well, it's hard to tell. I mean, it's a very precise science, I'm telling you. I'm discovering who these red coats are. But if you have a runoff election, it's going to eliminate a lot of these candidates that got elected with, you know, 30% of the vote. So if you go back, and I encourage everybody to go back and watch the Corporations Committee hearing, just so you understand what we're talking about. You had, you know, a whole committee, and I think I'm pretty safe in saying there wasn't a conservative on that whole committee. So when they jump in favor of an open primary, well, that reinforces the method by which they got elected. And if they say, well, ranked choice voting, well, then that reinforces the method by which they got elected. And the one that doesn't is the runoff election, because you have to have 50% plus one. So if you're the person that gets to go toward that runoff election, well, most people are going to find out exactly what type of candidate you are, and you're not going to win. And that's why there's opposition. Now, when they say, well, time and money, that's the one that they that all of these redcoats think resonates with the rest of the people, right? It's going to cost us way too much money to do this. We don't have enough time. When in the reality of it is, well, yes, it's going to cost a little bit more to run the election, but really, we can fix it to where we have enough time. And so, I mean, that's, in my opinion, the runoff election is the way we need to go. Or the ultimate solution is to completely get the state out of the party system and Probably. Let us run our own primary.
Joey?
I guess my biggest question is if time, and I'm guessing that means the calendar timeline during an election, and money is an issue, then why do we not, on the time scale, use special elections more often for certain things? And if money's the issue, why do we even have authorization for special elections? Why did we just spend how much money in Johnson County to find out that people don't want a tax they were telling you they didn't want? So
$62,000 is the number I heard.
I think in most situations when people, especially legislators, want to argue or look at a situation, they want to stand too close to the forest and they don't want to apply it to all the other things that are existent in Title 22, which governs all of our different types of elections. Let me go back all the way to the beginning with the ranked choice. I consider ranked choice the common core of elections. It's just a common core of elections. And my biggest, if you could either tell me, well, Joey, you're just too dumb to understand it, or you're being a pain and not wanting to understand it, it will never answer the main question I have of, if we have so much trouble in our current system with tabulating ballots that have for and against choices, how are we going to have any trust in the integrity of a system that has to mathematically rank, compile, read?
As soon as you throw in that word algorithm, my blood runs cold.
Oh boy!
And it's just
we have paper ballot that marks as one.
The number one thing we need in elections is a legitimate result. The second thing we need to trust that legitimate result is integrity. And it doesn't matter if the elections are run properly or not. If people don't trust them, then you have less participants and more people, you know, defaming what we really have that's good on paper that's not properly enforced. So rank choice for me is out. The jungle primary, the open primary, whatever you want to call it, that takes us from a false perception of a two-party system to a guarantee of a one-party system.
Yes, absolutely.
Just out the window. And I won't get too much into that. As far as the runoff goes, and I testified to this, that I don't think it's the ultimate answer. I think it's the correct step for right now. It's funny that it's the only choice that requires a constitutional amendment to pass. And in order to pass a constitutional amendment in the state of Wyoming, you have to have 50 plus 1% of the voters.
Even if
the majority vote for it, if it's not a majority of the registered voters, it doesn't matter how many ballots say yes. It has to be a majority of the people that registered to vote in that election. So to answer this question, we have to utilize the system for this question. So even the failure of that would prove that it's necessary because it's the standard somewhere else. I think it's the perfect jumping off point, looking at whatever problems you have with runoffs can be fixed by passing runoffs and maybe even getting rid of it before we ever use it. And I have already rewritten Title 22 to get rid of Chapter 4, Article 1, which is the major political party section. And that's all you have to do. We changed a couple of words further down. We removed the word partisan from almost everything. But the language for the parties to properly be able to conduct themselves as private organizations already exists in Article 3 under minor political parties. You just get rid of the word minor. So we have a thing called political parties.
Which is everybody's the same, right?
Yeah. But the best part is nobody can argue it. LSO, lawyers, judges can't argue it because it's already been part of our statute for over 35 years. The other thing, and I got into this a little bit with one of the senators at the committee, they said, well, you think this, well, you think that, maybe the party, lawsuits and this. I said, it doesn't matter because you've never asked that question of the minor parties in 35 years, so you can't pretend to be concerned now. there really is no legitimate argument other than we're giving up our perceived power and illegitimate control over elections by pretending we're members of this party in the way it's run right now. That's the only argument against it, and I think it's the way we have to go. Nobody cares how the libertarians get their candidates. You can't pretend you would all of a sudden care because it's the party that you benefit from the most, not the one that you are most committed to the principles of, not the one that you support the most in your actions, but the one that you benefit from. It gets into the whole brand thievery thing. And yes, there's going to be a price to pay. The parties themselves are going to have to do the work. The parties are going to have to grow. They're going to have to find a way to bring people in, keep people, keep them involved. And it's probably going to reduce the active participation in the Republican Party, at least on the registration numbers, and give us that multi-party system that we already have on paper. I think it would be a boon for the libertarians. Now we have to do our own balloting. You know, we're not benefiting financially from the government doing the Republican Party's work. People will say, well, the Republicans are now starting to hold people accountable to their values. The only way I could get elected or even on a ballot with a party is to go and actually be the Democrat I am. And I think you're going to start to see, if we take this on and have it be successful, you're going to see a balance amongst some of those party numbers. I still think the Republican Party will be very strong, mm-hmm. but we will be shedding a lot of fat.
Well, and that's a good point too, Joey, that like this, a runoff election bill will help the Democrat Party.
Right.
Because those folks who are, you know, put that R beside their name, but they're really, you know, Democrats who can't spell, you know, they're going to have to go join the Democrat Party. So really,
it would strengthen them.
It would strengthen them.
It would give them some good candidates for once.
Yeah.
Well, define good. You keep on using that word.
I know.
I don't think it means what you think it means.
It doesn't. I don't mean in that context.
Okay.
They'd have some viable candidates. How's that? I have a question.
I have an answer. Maybe they'll match.
Okay, cool. This came up when we were talking about redistricting, and you know, you mentioned that little section of Johnson County that runs up into Leiter and Arvada in that area. Mm-hmm. So if I live in Leiter, I don't know if anybody lives in Leiter.
There's like a couple people.
Yeah. So if I live at the bar in Leiter.
Some people do.
Which I had lunch there recently.
What else are you
going to do? It was quite good.
Good burgers.
Yeah. But if I lived there and I wanted to run for House Rep, do I have to go to Johnson County to register or Sheridan County, or do I have to go to both?
Neither. You register with the Secretary of State for state legislative office.
Oh, and then they tell the counties what to do?
Well, okay. they tell the county who is on their list of registered voters.
Okay.
They transmit the data so that the ballots can be populated and formulated.
Okay.
Your county clerk will publish, by law must publish, what's called a proclamation of election.
Right.
And that'll include all of the offices and the names of people running for those, or how many positions there are and mm-hmm. all that stuff. That comes from the collection of everybody who registers at the county clerk's office, municipal stuff, and then what's transmitted from the Secretary of State. But yeah, most of those statewide offices, you would register at the Secretary of State.
Okay.
So I have a question very similar to that, and I'm going to direct this to Joey because he likes the ideas of counties and the arbitrary lines. It seems to me that if the ultimate way, and there is no ultimate way, but the best way to try to divvy up the people so that each of these areas, each of these districts are equal, you might have to step over some county lines, as we already have had to do. Is it possible to change the office of a county clerk to a district or a clerk of the Senate and the representative districts?
I love that everybody's being very thoughtful on how to work around or within, you know, law. No, because a county is a very specifically defined political subdivision, mm-hmm. And it has nothing to do with legislative districts. Precincts. Legislative districts don't even follow precincts. You have some precincts that are cut right in half by a legislative district.
Yeah.
So I don't think that would be effective. I think it would be, or even legal, I think the easiest way to do kind of what you're talking about that is already on the books, and the process is actually amazingly easy, is to actually change county lines.
Yeah.
the county boundaries themselves.
That'll never happen.
And
so you mean Johnson County can have Sheridan County
boundaries? And you would constantly be on a sliding scale.
If, get to Toronto County, too.
If we're going to...
And all the way to the south southern border.
That's right.
And I said that because I know it's on the books. I know how, you know, there is a process laid out for that. But do you really want the boundaries of your counties being on a sliding scale every 10 years to chase election districts? There's just no way I see anybody getting behind that. But I would, since we're talking about county clerks and elections, especially if the party ends up owning their own primaries, I would be totally on board with taking every elected position at the county level that's not the clerks, or sorry, that's not the commissioners or the sheriff, and making all those nonpartisan, because those are nonpartisan jobs. Mm-hmm. Those are not policy making or policy enforcing jobs. Let me find out what the actual, you know, trial looks like of a county assessor who assesses one guy's property because he's a Democrat a certain way, and then differently because the neighbor's a Republican. Actually, they probably get away with it, but
Have I mentioned Johnson County?
You can't do those jobs in a partisan manner, and I don't know that it's necessary that they would need to be elected by the party thing. But as far as changing the lines or the district jobs, that would almost turn the county clerk into kind of like a branch of the LSO where they're servicing the legislature, mm-hmm. not the people of the county. And so I just don't think that's realistic.
I mean, I think the best solution is to just get it set and not have to change, you know, county boundaries. Or, I mean, of course, you're going to have to redistrict a little bit here or there. But for the most part, just get it set and, you know, make it work and just go with it.
Well, the only thing that compels us to redistrict is the fact that the Constitution says when we have a census, we will redistrict. There's no cap on redistricting. We could redistrict every year if we wanted. We just wouldn't have any data to redistrict. And the reason why the census triggers that, our Constitution says we must do it whenever the federal census happens. But because the census provides us the data that brings the 14th Amendment and the one person, one vote into play, so we got to try to make sure those numbers... the legislature has to make sure those numbers are getting close. So setting them permanently would be the same argument as just setting them county lines. Mm-hmm. Is just, hey, this is the way we feel. What I think is going to be most interesting is if the legislature actually takes my recommendation and tries to bring a resolution to amend the Constitution to make our Constitution say what they're doing is the way you do it. And then it goes to the vote of people and it fails. What do you do then? I mean, they still have judicial relief, but they have got to, as representatives of the people, recognize the people don't want this. And that should compel our attorney general and our legislature to go and say, we're going to have another legal fight over this because the state, people of the state of Wyoming, you know, don't want this. And it's all because, you know, the supremacy clause is not a unilateral action. And that's what they've been using it as. They said, hey, Constitution of the United States, supreme law of the land. I agree with that. But when a judge makes a determination, it does not automatically alter a constitution. It does automatically repeal a law. That is the legislature's job. And if they can't get it done, then they have to bend to the will of the people or dread the next election.
Speaking of the will of the people, let's make that attorney general an elected office.
Absolutely.
Instead of appointed.
Does that require a constitutional change to have an elected attorney general or not?
I don't think so.
I don't think it would require a constitutional change to make it happen. We would probably want to make a constitutional expansion so that we could constitutionally give them powers, duties, and responsibilities that aren't easily changed at the legislative level. I would be pretty uncomfortable going more than 2 years, you know, a full round of legislative sessions without getting an elected AG into the Constitution somehow.
Yeah.
Too much wiggle room in them statutes. Good idea, Ferry flies around those chambers and changes laws real easy.
Because we've seen the problems with an unelected AG in these past couple of years. And where you have attorney generals from other states who are elected signing on to certain lawsuits against federal government overreach. In Wyoming, there's crickets. Nothing happens.
Well, and the problem we see right now is that the Attorney General is not accountable to the people, to anybody, really.
Yeah.
And, you know, so there's nothing we can do to force Bridget Hill to take any action, much less sit in her chair and do nothing like she's doing right now. Yeah. And the result of that is you have her suing private organizations to reveal their donors when they're not legally compelled to. You know, and say what you want about that organization in question, but they're not legally compelled to release their donors, and yet our Attorney General and the Secretary of State sued them,
right,
to try to force them to reveal their donors. So, I personally think if the Attorney General was elected, it would probably solve a lot of those problems because she'd be accountable to the voters.
If she were elected, I suspect that as soon as President Biden steps up and says, if you have over 100 people in your small business, we're going to mandate vaccinations through OSHA, she'd be one of the first ones, knowing that she has to represent us, she'd be one of the first ones up there throwing a fit. As it is, she got to wait for Governor Miss the Mark to give her cue that it's okay because she works for him rather than for us. We need to change some things.
Well, and that's, you know, I've heard Joey mention this a number of times, that our Attorney General needs to defend the people, not the government.
Yes.
Well, what it really is it's having a governing document as strong as the Constitution that compels that individual. And you, because it's there, you know it going in. When you run for Attorney General, when this happens, you know you are beholden to the people, because the job of every elected official and every state employee, but mostly the elected officials and the appointed department heads, is not to run the state for the benefit of the state or the brand of Wyoming. It's to administer the government on behalf of the people who all powers of government are inherent in. That is it. And I'm not talking about mob rule. I'm not talking about, oh, we're mad enough, you have to do what we want. I will pull support from an action, even if there's personal interest in it for me, once it goes beyond the lines of constitutional enumerated power or expanding liberty and reducing government. If it goes the other way, even if I benefit from it, I'll say, no, I cannot fundamentally support it. I don't know if there's a whole lot of people out there like me that would do that and say, no, they're giving us free stuff too. But the bottom line is, the governor's job is to be the chief executive officer of the departments that administer government on our behalf. The Attorney General, elected or not, their job is to be the lawyer for the people through the rights protected by our Constitution from other governmental entities or other states infringing on them, because the power of that government is inherent in us. We've lost that. I don't know if some of them ever knew that. I mean, I'm sure there's people listening right now, they're like, what? But it's right there at the very beginning of the Constitution. That's what it is.
One of the things you frequently hear from legislators is that I'm going to vote my conscience.
Run as an independent. Barf.
And they don't, you know, especially when you start talking about Republican Party platform, I'm going to vote my conscience. Okay, what's that saying? Is that saying is that you don't care about what the people who elected you think. You don't care about the party that you aligned yourself with think. You're going to pull Liz Cheney and vote your conscience instead of what your people you're elected to represent want, and it's a piss poor way out.
Well, and you know, we keep mentioning the Constitution, and Joey alluded to Article 1, Section 1. It's the very first thing in the Wyoming Constitution, and it says all power is inherent in the people, and all free governments are founded on their authority and instituted for their peace, safety, and happiness, for the advancement of these ends. They have at all times an inalienable and indefeasible right to alter, reform, or abolish the government in any manner they think proper. And every single one of these elected officials takes an oath to uphold the Constitution, when the very first thing says that their power, or their elected office's power, resides with the people.
Incidentally, and I don't want to start a whole new discussion, but that same document gives the right to medical decisions for an individual to whom?
I cannot answer your question because it's based in the form of a lie. The Constitution doesn't give us right.
God
the
does.
The Constitution limits the government's ability to infringe on our well rights, put. But it gives recognition to that God-given right to the individual and to the parent of any child in their care.